you have to walk away. We had an uncle when we were children, Chester, or Uncle Chet, as we called him. At some point, Uncle Chet married a woman and moved away to New Hampshire. Shortly afterwards, he let the family know that he was no longer interested in being part of it. From what I know, it wasn't contentious. It was just a choice that Chester made. Nobody seemed to understand, but at the same time, I don't remember anyone being very much curious. It was just something they accepted and moved on. My brother was the last of any blood relative that I was close to or dealt with on a regular basis, or alive for that matter. When we parted ways, I felt like I knew why Uncle Chet had to walk off into the sunset. Relatives are something you're born with. Family, to me, are the relationships that I've built or corralled and barely maintained over my life. Blood is thicker than water, but in this family, vodka, lithium, and the innate ability to read any given individual's needs and boundaries is far more paramount than some incidental strand of DNA. I walked away from my brother without anger or contempt. I just didn't trust him anymore, nor did he me. I've never looked back. The saying that life is too short carries a heavier weight when you feel like the credits in this movie could start rolling at any time. No doubt that alcohol takes a lot of the credit for this deadening of the nerves and the evacuation of emotions. You learn to triage. You find out who needs you first and what has to be taken care of before anything else. I'm always spinning my own mental plates on an hourly basis. I'm a control freak naturally, and that peaks when I'm most out of control and forget that other people already have it covered. There are moments of clarity when you realize that everything is actually working smoothly, without your help or in spite of you. And then you start drinking again. But when you're shivering with the booze creeps, so much of your day is trying to tread water over the riptides of uncertainty, the self-doubt and defeatism, that you can forget that people still count on you, that they will still love you, and that they may be under the impression that you're doing just fine. You become delusional in thinking that any confidence you feel at all is in fact the real delusion. And this can be your undoing. The cliche that you cannot love anyone else if you can't love yourself works both ways. If you hate yourself, you can assume everyone else does as well. And then you can become antagonistic towards them without warrant, until such time as your head clears and you no longer feel that way. But now you still think they still hate you for that time you were spiteful to them because you hated yourself. This is why blind trust is as crucial to our social circle as is understanding. Anyone who threatens it is cut out like a tumor. I used to have a wife who would try to degrade me for surrounding myself with yes men, with ass kissers, when I didn't even have an ass to kiss. But the truth is that the friends I've surrounded myself with were the ones who were prone to forgiveness and seeing intent over action. People who felt comfortable enough to celebrate and mock each other's weaknesses while building each other's strengths. Besides, who would surround themselves with assholes who don't like them? Yes, men. Would you prefer no men? Chapter 10. Lost in the Funhouse. If I ever had a strength, it was in bringing people together. If I can use the term ringleader with a bit of self-deprecation. I had the ability to find great people, make it into a party, and then let them fend for themselves in order to find each other. I generally step aside before I'm discovered to be a fraud, before you realize that I've forgotten your name or exactly how I know you. Minor details, but some people take umbrage to these small lapses in memory. Like a book or a movie, at best I retained whether I liked it or not. The details as to why often escape me. All that matters is that I know you belong. One inadvertent key to hosting parties that I've found is that I'm always losing my drink. This requires me to constantly be wandering around folks, to duck into conversations long enough to be social, but with no obligation to come up with something to say on my own other than, "Hang on, where's my fucking drink?" Yet through that, so many people did find each other and have become lifelong friends with circles within our circle. For the most part, I don't keep in touch with people who aren't right in front of me. I'm all self-interest or self-preservation, depending on the day or on the moment. My world is usually consumed with the anxiety that whatever I'm doing, I should be doing something else more important that I've forgotten. In the ugliest of hours, I can write it off like that. I made great friends out of people I was never there for or that I let down. Sometimes I think that my greatest strength was to be the common enemy, the guy who invited everyone to his own grand event but passed out before the show even started. However it worked, it turned out to be pretty fucking okay. Some of our core group were natural fits, love at first sight kind of folk. Joby was one of our first friends in Bisbee when we just moved here in 2005, MySpace days. Joby, maybe 10 years my junior, found me on MySpace and said hello, or maybe I found him. He came to our first New Year's Eve party, mostly full of out-of-town friends I'd known from the road. Back then, the house was a skeleton of what it is today. My friends had imagined a compound. People slept wherever they could find warm space. The couch, the floor, the crawl space. Where the funhouse now stands was just a moon-cratered and desert scrub lot where I'd parked an elderly and barely running RV. I'd seen it for sale locally for $1,500 and figured it had enough sleeping space for the stragglers at the party. I painted chump storage across the windshield in watercolor, and I'll be damned if every bed didn't get used. Joby was one of the only locals at the party, from what I recall. He and I tripped hard on mushrooms that night, his honey yellow Fabio locks dancing across his face in the cold night breeze, with a vivid starlit sky and waxing crescent moon as a backdrop. One solid psychedelic experience together can be equal to a lifetime of friendship. Some people will show you around their house at a party, but when you trip together, you're giving them a tour of your soul. Joby could do everything I could not do, as well as everything I could do, only better. Kind of like a washtub Willie who doesn't steal your girl. He could build shit and fix shit and weld shit and cook shit and take shit from the world without ever seemingly letting it get to him. He could also drink and smoke and trip his ass into pieces without ever losing his shit and put you to bed when you couldn't keep up with the workload. And then he'd clean up and put everything back into place before you woke up in a sweating heap of panic. He'd also turn out to be a magnet for death. Death follows him everywhere, and he takes this in stride as well. He's cleaned up suicides of close friends with the same calm and compassion as he would the vomit of an overserved party guest. He's unshakable in his stoic demeanor. Joby was and is a rock, even when he himself is spiraling out. I secretly hate him for it, and I tell him so every time we drink, because I stink at keeping secrets. Years later, we found Chad Shank, Facebook days, or he found us. There was some disabled veteran who lived a few houses down from me who needed help moving, and some other random twat on Facebook was pestering me to lend a hand. I'm fine with helping people, but heavy lifting isn't a strong suit, nor is any lifting. But that random guy broke me down. I posted late one night that some crippled vet needed help, and if anyone wanted to join in the next morning, it would be greatly appreciated. I made sure to add that there would be no way I would show up either if I were them. But they did. Maybe 8 or so folks showed up to help this guy move his shit into storage. And every one of these volunteers who showed up on an overnight whim turned out to be far more disabled than the vet they were helping. The vet was in his early 30s, fit if not a bit doughy, and his disability was a bit of hearing loss from training in a bombing range. We all shrugged our shoulders, said nothing, and moved his shit into storage. And one of those people that showed up to help was Chad Shank. It would take a long time for me to understand the sheer improbability of Chad to show up at all, anywhere. This many years later, it still makes less and less sense. Chad, a barrel-chested behemoth outfitted like a do-rag biker with a voice built to quake your bowels, lives about 40 minutes away and for the most part is a shut-in and a graduate-level case study of anger management. He is also, like Joby, a magnet for death. Not just his ability to clean up after it, but to plan it and fight his own internal inclination to inflict it upon others. He's also obscenely intelligent and hyper-aware of his own idiosyncrasies. He knows he is a danger to himself and others, and maybe to some of the others around the others. So he doesn't leave the house. To this day, a decade later, the idea that he would show up early in the morning to help some stranger hump boxes because another stranger put out a last call plea on social media is baffling. But Chad and I hit it off immediately. Chad understood comedy, or at least my brand. Not an easy find in a small town. He also shared my mistrust and disgust of the outside world in general. Odd when misanthropy becomes the tie that binds. Over time, Chad has become the reticent co-host of the podcast as well as the highlight. He hates going out of his house as much or more than he ever did. He hates himself even more in the morning if he dared to have fun the night before. And that's another of the many things we have in common. We enjoy the shared belief that we are better than everybody, while at the same time still self-aware that we are chunks of dog shit as human beings. Better still, Joby and Chad became soulmates in their obsession with seclusion, firearms, darts, and death. Joby's more resigned, where Chad is more proactive. But the common bond is still an optimistic fatalism. More than once, they've each pulled out the bullet that they carry in their pocket as the one meant to end their own lives. They do it in a way that any other party people would compare charm bracelets or tribal tattoos. Joby has a .45 caliber that he took from the scene of a friend's suicide. Chad carries a .40 caliber. I don't know how many times they've debated their choice of one gauge over the other, but I bet those conversations were held in high spirits. And I know they're both in agreement on one element, hollow points. In the words of Chad Shank, they're designed to make sure whatever you shoot dies. These are the people we know we can count on. They're two of my best friends, a term that I have embarrassingly given too much weight for too long. When you're young, it's only a matter of time before you bestow the title of best friend upon another, unless nobody likes you. But for most of us as children, this designation is given to someone with the same weight as you would later give in having someone as a spouse, and with the same rate of divorce. Then, as you age, you find out you have more than one best friend, and you become clumsy when you call one of them your best friend without a disclaimer for the others. Matt Becker was my best friend, and when I didn't see him for some years, Andy Andrus became my best friend. But always with the footnote, crediting Matt Becker with a co-best friend credit. This went on into my 40s. Far too old to have not figured out how to simply say one of my best friends. Maybe I bear too much guilt from a lifetime of infidelity. But there's no doubt that for too many years to count or remember, Greg Chaley has been without question the most important, most dependable, and most loyal best friend. He's also made himself the most forgettable or even initially unlikable to others. By nature or by design, Chaley seems to disappear into the moment and into the memory. Or he's that guy you think hates you. But he makes everything work and gets none of the glory. That's what he does. He handles every problem, he fixes any obstacle. While you make the party start, he makes it go off as planned. You remember the band on the patio, but you never noticed that he made all of the instruments, sound, and lighting be functioning. And he filled in on bass. He gets no accolades, nor does he desire them. You remember the great shows on the road, or more importantly, the worst. But you forgot that he was the guy who got you there, got you paid, got you home, and had breakfast tacos at your bedside in the hotel the next morning. all while getting little or no sleep while he edited the podcast, did accounting, and stopped you from pissing into the air conditioner when you woke up in a blackout and thought it was the ladies' room. Too many times I've recounted a foggy memory to Chaley only to hear the incredulous yet bored retort of, "I know, I was there. I did a gig with Mitch Hedberg 2 weeks before he died. We were doing coke in the hotel room after the show, and I know, I was there. I snorted mother's ashes in coke. I know, I was there. I can still taste it in the back of my throat." These two examples are notable in that they both include cocaine. As a daily drunkard, you're far more likely to remember things when blow was involved. It's not that Chaley isn't memorable as a personality. He's engaging and genuinely interested in people. I remember him having a long conversation in Winnipeg once with a cab driver on the way to the airport one morning. The gist was something to do with the difference between being Sikh and Shiite, something that was loud and confused with a stumbling language barrier, something I felt in my stewing hangover didn't need to be discussed. After we got to the airport, I chastised him for stoking unnecessary chatter, as though he did it just to annoy me. He told me it was because he was honestly captivated. I never said I understand Chaley. I just love and respect him, even when I forget he was there. The main point is that Chaley knows how to allow me my tirades, my proclivities, and has never judged me, even when I was absolutely wrong. He knows I will wake up unaware of where I am and will leave a note on top of some gummies to remind me. And to this day, I still kind of take it for granted. I have a lot of best friends. Some you classify with an asterisk or by a time period, like a boxing champion, reigning best friend from 1986 to 1990. Best friend during that brief meth experimentation time. However brief, we told each other so much that night. Best friend even though he fucked my girl, but we're still cool. These things happen. I have a lot of best friends. But when I sat down with a lawyer to make out a will and had to evaluate who I would trust with everything that might be left to inventory, curate, or parcel out fairly, Chaley was the only one I knew I could trust without thinking. Hennigan wouldn't want the problems. An estate of any measure in Bingo's hands is a monkey with a shotgun. Andrist or Becker? Someone aiming a shotgun at a monkey. In my will, I left Chaley's wife, Tracy, as a backup beneficiary in case Greg Chaley died before I did, or at the same time as I did, knowing how little he sleeps and could easily fall asleep at the wheel of the tour van at any given moment. Tracy's my other best friend, who also holds the distinction of being the only person who has never bothered me, who over the years has literally never annoyed me on any level, and I'm easily annoyed. I don't know what it is about Tracy. She has plenty of interests, yet still no agenda. She lives always at the forefront of the background. Where Chaley has so many irons in the fire, she's content just to keep that fire burning without gripe or seemingly put out on any level. She has no master plan, but will quietly do everything in her power to help you facilitate your own. She loves to gossip, but has no dog in the fight. The best of my writing in any book is when she was in the funhouse with me. She's content to sit and yarn coasters while she watches hockey as I plink away on the keys, waiting for me to occasionally ruin her silence by reading aloud passages that I think are genius or clunky or simply looking for the right word, putting her English major to work. There is no quid pro quo for this. Too often people only listen to you talk waiting for their own turn. Tracy has none of that. She allows me to be selfish. She will overserve me when she plays the role of bartender, yet never judge me when I pass out behind the bar at her feet. And she could be blackout drunk with me while carrying a composure that would make you think she'd never touched a drop, always with a retiring smile, a gentle smile that persists even when I have come unglued crying. Perhaps Tracy has never been annoying to me because she has never once seemed annoyed by me, and I'm annoying as fuck. Tracy's the one person that I tell all of my ugliest secrets to. The stuff that even Chaley doesn't want to hear or want any part in knowing. The parts I couldn't even write in this book. And if Tracy dies first, it's because I got itchy and thought she knew too much. In my will, I left Chaley's wife Tracy, together known as the Traileys. Burn those sheets, Traileys. I'll buy you new ones in the morning. The Scotsman Hennigan doesn't live in Bisbee. We really don't know where he lives. Los Angeles? Vegas? Somewhere plotting something, wringing his hands and cackling. He's my business partner and one of my best friends, but the kind you can count on never needing shit from you. Nobody really knows what he's up to, and we stopped asking years ago. Everyone has their own problems at a certain age, but Hennigan makes all the deals and books all the shows. It's not our concern if he spends his off time being tinkled on by corpulent and leather-clad bears in a depraved swinger dungeon or playing the accordion in a polka band. That's his business. All we know is that he's on top of our shit, and sometimes he surprises us with a rare show of emotion and kindness. Just after Bingo and I broke up at sea, Hennigan sent her this email.
Oh, hi, Bingo. It's Brian. I just wanted to send a wee note to say that if you need anything whatsoever, oh, you only need to ask. I'm very confidential, so don't worry about me telling anyone if you do need something. Also, don't forget that whatever else, you're a wonderful, talented, delightful person who's worked hard to deal with a lot of shit. You can deal with anything. Never forget that you've brought Bingo joy and Bingo happiness into the lives of many, many people all over the world. Keep doing that. And again, never worry about asking for anything, including a chat. Hope to see you soon. Love, but not that kind. You,
Brian. He didn't send me shit. Our core in Bisbee alone spills out into literally dozens of solid friends who will show up to plug any hole or lean into any collapsing wall in order to keep the wheels churning. Even Washtub Willie, who in any other circumstance or mindset might have been a rival, was an asset when things turned ugly. There's a lot of people who made this outfit strong. But instead of trying to include them all, I'll just go to the bottom rung. Reverend Derek and Castle Rock Kenny, the Beavis and Butthead of the Funhouse, at least in that year of 2016. They were two adult teenage ne'er-do-wells who we'd adopted, who came into our fold no differently than the stray pets that stumbled onto our door. Two stoners whose idiocy and incompetence were works of art in themselves. I say this here because I don't see them often enough to enjoy saying it to their faces, and I see them all the time. Beautiful morons or genius retards. But as much as Chaley or Hennigan keep the ball in play, you also need people to tend the field. Everybody who could bring something to the party did. Beer or brats or even just a bag of ice. Those who had nothing to bring, Kenny and Derek, gave their time and effort. And the time and effort that Kenny and Derek put in dragged like the clock on the last day of school, with equal attention given to their assignments. But we still couldn't have done as much without them. When my cat Meatwig was found immobilized with a dislocated hip just as I was leaving for the road, Derek was there to get him to Phoenix for a $3,500 surgery and then tend to him through weeks of constant rehab. On one of those days, snow had fallen, which is not unheard of in Bisbee. But it fell deep enough to block the pet door when Meatwig needed to shit. So Meatwig shit on Derek's sleeping chest out of spite. Derek thought it was funny. Kenny was always there to be your sober driver in town or to wake up last minute to drive the 100 miles to pick up a friend at the Tucson airport, one that you'd forgotten you'd invited. Derek and Kenny are both components of what keeps this place afloat, despite the fact that they are bickering idiots with no goals, skills, or competence. Sometimes those are the people you can count on the most. Henry Rollins once said, "Allow me my insanity and I will stay in your heart with the tenacity of a crab louse." When you tread a road this reckless, you find out who your friends are. And this year I'd find out that I had so many more than I could imagine, and that ultimately I was going to need every one of them. Chapter 11. The Mayor of Bisbee. At some point that spring, USA Today ran a clickbait campaign for the best historic small town in America. Bisbee made the cut and was sitting in 19th place out of 20 when I implored my fans, the Killer Termites, to get online and rock the vote. In no time, we soared to the number one spot and eventually won the title. Maybe not the biggest deal to you, but this town doesn't get a lot of notice. I spoke at the city council, where I was known to show up occasionally and expound on the issues of the day in whatever buffoonish manner that usually rubbed the esteemed panel the wrong way. The mayor was not a fan. But I still showed up again to implore the council to designate an official day to the fans who gave us the top credit on the town's resume. The ayes had it, and July 3rd, 2016 would be officially recognized as Killer Termite Day. I smile every time I see the USA Today designation on all of Bisbee's tourism brochures and advertisements. Drunk on this tiny amount of power, we decided then that we should run Kenny and Derek against each other for the upcoming mayoral election. This would never happen, of course. They'd have to do things like ask for signatures, a task they wouldn't even attempt when everyone was already right there in front of them in the funhouse watching football. Still, we held mock debates on the podcast. Derek wanted to put a Hooters on the bucolic yet barren Arizona street, walking distance from his place. Kenny wanted to bring a Canadian Football League team to town. It was impossible to think that people could ever believe any of this, but this is a town that is so bored that it will gulp down gossip-like energy drinks. As word spread from the podcast and circulated, it was clear that a lot of the town was terrified we might pull this off. Having seen how my fans rigged the USA Today vote, the idea that Castle Rock Kenny, nicknamed for the downtown rock landmark where he'd once made a meth-fueled spectacle of a suicide threat, could now become the grand poobah of Bisbee for the next 2 years, seemed plausible. They didn't grasp the fact that the best small town votes came from all over the world, not just Bisbee. Even some of the council members and running candidates gently came to me in fear that we would actually support and promote these dope-headed bozos. We let them sweat until it was obvious that it was all just a lark. Chapter 12. Tour de Farce. My first book, Digging Up Mother, was a Hennigan brainchild just after Mother's suicide in 2008. He came to the funhouse and we sat for days trying to piece together a timeline of my relationship with my mother since childhood. Facts and memories long absent from anything I'd ever found important to call to mind. After days of poring over crates of sparse crawl space memorabilia and repeated failures to jumpstart recollections, Hennigan broke down and screamed, "We can't have an entire book of I don't fucking remember." Yet somehow we pieced together a treatment for a book, and it went to a literary agent, and he took it nowhere. In fact, it took me years just to make her suicide into a stage-ready 7-minute bit. It wasn't until that bit was filmed on a special and aired on Netflix that the agent sprung out of a cupboard and wondered why we never sold that book idea. And so it was sold, and then I was forced to remember. Writing that book was grinding and painful, but I'd already cashed the check. I holed up in what we call the bomb shelter at the Quiet House for half of 2015. A cinder block shed maybe 16 by 16, with the hideous fluorescent lights of a dirt town auto body shop. Secluded to the point of madness, surrounded by boxes and tubs of old photos and cards and letters and any blue-tip match that might spark a memory. breaking down in tears like I'd been under intense grilling by a sadistic interrogator inside my own head was a nightly occurrence. These were not memories of brutality or anything suppressed. It was mostly the fact that I was remembering anything at all. Drinking for a lifetime pushes most of your life into the present, running on instinct, logic, and whatever is standing in front of your face at the moment. Memory is trivia. Facing all of that in a concrete tomb over the course of months brought out heavier emotions than alcohol could stave off. By the time I was done, I was somewhat satisfied with the outcome. I really had no outside feedback. The entire process was not what I'd expected. I'd never written a book, and I'd imagined reels of notes from an editor. If I pressed them for it, at best they would simply tell me that it was good and nothing more. I had doubts as to if they'd even read it. Hennigan, who'd published novels of his own, concurred, "It's fine." Not a hint of suggestion for changes. It became obvious that nobody really gave a fuck. The publishers assumed it would sell regardless of their input, and Hennigan was just satisfied we'd gotten the check. That's his job. In May of 2016, the book was released, and I'd be going out on my first book tour, starting with 3 days in New York City. After so long in a world absent of change, I was giddy as a piglet to be stumbling into some new unknown. I'm a motherfucking book writer now, an authory type of guy. I wasn't expecting Oprah's book club, or maybe I was. When you prolapse your anus this much on a project that is brand new for you, your expectations can run wild in either direction. Either way, I expected a lot more than what was coming. Turned out that the media tour was hardly different at all from the same shit I'd been doing regularly for my comedy career. And for a lot of it, the publisher was counting on me to book it. Not that I was really excited at the delusions of maybe random appearances on Rachel Ray or some other nonsense. I just expected something new and outside the comedy world. The only difference was that, although most of these appearances were the same media outlets I was used to, now they were all stacked one on top of the other. In that first leg in New York, I did 27 interviews in 3 days. That's a lot of repeating yourself, especially when you have no answers to what would seem like the easiest of questions. So what's your book about? Hadn't thought of an entertaining answer. This was common for my interviews for my stand-up. What made you want to be a comedian? Where do you get your ideas from? Fucked if I know. It's like being on a game show where the subject is you and you're still losing. To say that the book was about my life with my mother would sound not only like a book I wouldn't buy, but also an interview I wouldn't listen to. If I went straight for the dirt, mother jacking off the family dog or losing my virginity at 9 years old, it would sound like heavy-handed shock and edge. For the most part, I'd just say it was about killing my mother. That first morning in New York City, I had 2 radio shows that I breezed through. Same as any day of talking into a microphone. Radio at this point was gasping for breath in the new dominance of the podcast world. But the third show at noon was Ron Bennington's Unmasked. I knew about his Ron and Fez radio show, but the Unmasked series were taped in front of a live studio audience. A small group of maybe 30, but still live and in an intimate setting, in a rectal examination kind of way. Think inside the actor's studio, in front of sober noontime people, intent on hearing some deep shit about this person they assume must have any depth at all. And then the nerves kicked in. Waking up with the serious booze shakes was fairly new to me, coming on for 6 months or so, but generally only at Safeway, getting stuck talking to people in the morning I wasn't comfortable with. Small tremors. Slight physical contortions. That feeling like you may involuntarily drop whatever's in your hands, but at the grocery store, I could just fake a phone call and walk away. As I sat down, watching this timid and expecting audience gather into their chairs, I felt that same Safeway physical awkwardness creep into me. Palpable agitation. I could feel my extremities peeling up like cerebral palsy. This is not my element. Radio is easy. But the fact that this was a live event sent my nervous system into fight or flight, and my plane had already left without me. I was about to be doing a live show sober to sober people without an act, where I'd have to answer these unanswerable questions into the real faces of people who had expectations on what I had to say. And all I remember saying, quivering and repeatedly, was, "Ah, fuck, I seriously need a drink." I could feel spasms drift into my face like a stroke. But unlike the supermarket, I couldn't walk away. I had a bottle of water, but I realized when I tried to bring it to my lips, my trembling hand became even more obvious to the crowd. The more I became aware of it, the worse it became. Like how being worried about not being able to get a boner makes it even more difficult and then eventually unachievable altogether. Every question felt like hours, and every chuckle seemed like the nervous laugh of an audience watching a meltdown. If I cared to listen back to it, which I wouldn't, it might seem like just a tepid interview to any casual listener. But Brian and Bingo were there, and they knew something was completely off. They knew I was not in a good state, and for the rest of the promotional tour it was agreed I should never not be drinking if I was going to be professional. Alcohol became the problem and the solution all in the same morning. This began a dangerous trend. In the life of stand-up comedy, which I knew instinctively, I knew I would have to stay somewhat sober until the show. There was a learned timeline of when and how much to drink to make the hour on stage as loose as possible without being sloppy. But like filming the pilot, getting half-cocked to kick off 9 a.m. radio would be difficult to maintain through a full day of press ending with 9 p.m. media. Adderall can only carry a portion of the workload. When I would eventually become erratic and rambling, there was nothing to do but hope nobody was listening. However it went, it seemed like the book was doing well, according to Amazon algorithms at any given time. That math will never make sense to me. There was one point in pre-sales that my publisher called to tell me that my book was somewhere in the top 100 best-selling books, site-wide, he expounded. He said that they were happy if any of their authors ever hit the top 10,000. What he didn't know or realize that we finally established was this ranking happened just after we had sent out our mailing list blast. Amazon rankings change hourly, and I checked that too often. In May, on Friday the 13th, I saw the book ranked number 666 in sales. Mark of the Beast. Maybe Oprah would be calling after all. As we were leaving the New York City leg of the promo tour, we got the news that Infinitum Nile, Johnny Depp's production company, who for all we could see had only ever produced a large office with many idle employees on the payroll and little more, had sold my stand-up comedy special to the upstart CISO Network, who were coming in with a deep bankroll to try to rival Netflix and the like. It had now been 6 months since I filmed it, and I was desperate to get it out. I texted Johnny and said, "Hey, Chico, we sold the special. There is joy in Mudville. Thank you many pantloads for making it happen." I told him that I was at JFK, riddled with Xanax and Klonopin for the flight and headed to LA. I was coming out to do more book press and also to film comedian Ari Shaffir's television show, This Is Not Happening, a storytelling show on Comedy Central. The perfect place to get drunk and tell a story from my book while holding the book to promote the book. They'd put us up at the Standard Hotel just at the foot of Johnny Street, and I asked if he'd be around. He said he was, and that he'd be there and waiting. "I'll be on my roof, jacking off with Sterno. Great news!" When we arrived, I was plenty liquored up from the plane ride and ready to throw down. And by that, I mean sit around Johnny's house, chain-smoking, talking shit, and drinking wine. We have the same idea of what partying means. I peppered him with texts, imploring him in the most vulgar and insulting terms to begin uncorking bottles, but they all went unanswered. Fuck him. I was already too pie-eyed and had press early the next morning. The next day, I get a call from one of his flunkies who told me the reason Johnny didn't respond was that his mother had just died. And there I'd been calling him a pussy all night. You can't unsend those text messages. But the morning after, he sent word that he was up and about. So Bingo and I crashed his place with mimosa fixings, greeted by the familiar security warlords sitting around outside on the front gazebo, faces sodden in gloom. I asked how Johnny was doing, and they just looked down and shook their heads. But what I assumed was him grieving for his mother was something else all too familiar. His wife, Amber Heard, seemed to be fucking with his head again, I assume using this opportunity of his weakness to manipulate him even more and harder. The sight of Depp's team sullen and brooding outside the door of whatever movie set trailer or any one of the houses he might currently be occupying was more than commonplace. From the time we'd met them, Amber Heard seemed to have played the part of habitual instigator to Johnny's ever-doting placator. The cruel dysfunction in this marriage was nothing that you haven't seen up close with your own friends if you haven't suffered through it yourself. Someone close to you, stuck in an abusive relationship who will never concede that they are actually being abused, or, if they do, they'll blame it on any other circumstance or themselves and keep going in deeper and for worse. It's almost inconceivable to think that Johnny Depp, or anyone that famous, could be trapped in this kind of abyss of the heart. That someone of his stature, idolized, and let's face it, so throbbingly gorgeous that you'd find yourself, years later, still wearing a stolen scarf of his, tied into sheer lingerie, hidden under the facade of your otherwise manly trousers. That even the grand he, who could have anyone because he already had everything, would have to be tap dancing on the hour to avoid the shit and vitriol of a relentlessly scheming and belittling opportunist was at minimum disheartening. I've been on the other end of this in too many relationships myself. You become well-read in the dark arts of bullshit. Gaslighting is the word that, while used too often, fits best. You catch someone in an obvious lie, and then they just lie more blatantly to get out of it. Then you get enraged, only to be accused of having anger issues, and now they're enraged because of it. This takes the argument off topic and begins a new one that's even more contentious. When you try to bring it back to the original point, they bring up a time you've done something worse, without ever taking responsibility for their own current deceit in question. Now they've turned this into you trying to defend yourself, and even when you have indisputable, smoking gun proof of their duplicity, they'll just shout you down and filibuster you so that you can't finish the sentence. World star! Eventually, you just concede defeat or walk away to make it all stop. I've also been on the receiving end of physical violence, where a girlfriend punched me bloody, knowing that I'd never hit her back. When I called 911 and the cops showed up, she told them that I had beaten the shit out of her. I've written about this previously, but it's worth mentioning again. With my lips split and bleeding down my face, she went on to throw an unopened beer can at me in front of the officer. It ruined her credibility, but she didn't go to jail. But it got me out of that relationship, and that was far more important. So while I was incredulous that someone like Johnny could be in such a toxic situation, eventually I understood that the more humble and devoted the person, the better the likelihood that they'll stick something out even when it's clearly doomed, and eventually they will perish in the flames that they themselves were fanning. I never held my tongue around Johnny, mostly because I was always drinking around Johnny. I've been telling him what to do with his life since the day I met him. Alcohol can make me an unsolicited life coach, but I never touched on the Amber shit until it was too late. And after 9 drinks. That afternoon, Johnny was screaming his own fruitless defenses down hallways, trying to retain any portion of the pound of flesh that was in the process of being extorted by someone owed no debt, nearly inconsolable. All of this one day after his mother died, and here I was, pickled, bitching at him for being a bitch by putting up with that bitch. But he didn't bitch about it. Bingo and I left, and within hours, everything Johnny had foreseen came true. He'd called it that very day. Say what you will, but in the profile of an abuser, never did they lay down a tearful soliloquy as a cover story so that 11 hours later they'd have an alibi for throwing a phone across the room at an agitating spouse. But those were the allegations that would go out. In the ensuing days, I watched on Twitter as the mob vilified Depp as being a wife beater, and people actually attacked me online for being his friend. It was agonizing trying to hold my tongue, but I did not respond. It was not my place. But eventually I hit a breaking point. I called Johnny's sister to talk about my frustration and having to keep my mouth shut. With her tacit blessing, or at least that's how I read it, I decided to write a press release slash website update in Johnny's defense. It wasn't something you can argue on an individual basis in limited characters on Twitter, a lesson I still generally fail to comprehend. Lawyers pored over what I'd written before it was released to make sure it wasn't libelous. I was careful, but I didn't want to be. If I could have written what I wanted about Amber Heard, I would have cut out all the unnecessary grammar. No conjunctions, pronouns, adverbs, or any of that malarkey. It would simply be a tome of nouns and adjectives. The nouns you'd see coming, but those descriptives would leave welts. The lawyers okayed everything but the hilarious parts. Don't think my original version wasn't riddled with levity. But they only kept the parts that were sincere. You know I'd never do that in real life without throwing in some inappropriate jokes as a safety blanket. I knew there was going to be backlash. I knew that I'd be seen as a blind apologist, someone taking one side of a news story for my own ends rather than someone who had real-life knowledge. Johnny, for the moment, was publicly shit-smeared and feathered. And we didn't give a fuck because we knew the truth. Nobody ever approached me directly, but I was explicit to Hennigan. We would not take Johnny's forward out of my book or his production company off of my comedy special with CISO. We did have to dump the opening scene of that special that we'd filmed earlier. It began with Johnny and me asleep and spooning in his bed in our underwear. He with a large hunting knife resting haphazardly across my throat. The alarm goes off and he tells me I'm late for my taping. I run Benny Hill style, lost in the labyrinth of his estate, until I'm heaved over the immense metal gate at the front by his security thugs. It was pretty funny, but for obvious reasons, the knife to the throat seemed a bit too much for a man accused of domestic violence. Regardless, we were all Team Depp. Amber Heard ruined all the sycophantic elements of being friends with Johnny Depp. In any moment of self-doubt where I felt like a nobody and an interloper at Johnny's, she would meet me with a glance that seconded the vote. She'd curl up her face at the mere presence of me and Bingo at the table of their favorite upscale Beverly Hills restaurant to a point where it became physically uncomfortable for everyone in attendance. The tension was so palpable that almost nobody spoke, and when they did, it became more awkward still. The forced small talk putting an even harsher spotlight on the elephant in the room. So to know that Johnny would allow himself to be put through everything else that Amber could scar and tarnish him with, but never turn his back on me to appease her, there was never any thought of jumping ship for business reasons. When he was being wrongly castigated in the tabloids. The emperor still wore clothes. It's just that his coattails we were riding had fallen off. But we weren't about to scurry like rats. I hadn't heard from Johnny since that mimosa afternoon when he predicted his own demise. It was nearly a week later that he'd read what I released, and he sent me a text thanking me for what I'd written. Your fucking eulogy of Steve and Slim was a perfect bullseye and one of the most impassioned and caring things that anyone has ever done for me. Not only did you give these global dick-eating chumps of this rotten existence some proper shit to chew on, and they're off. A nearby dirty windows view. I'm just so fucking thankful for the truth and beautifully written truth. I'm proud to have you representing me. I truly was really goddamn moved to tears with your piece. It's so fucking rare when you meet a person where you just know the fucker's got your back. In any case, thank fuck I'm on the road in Europe. They'd be crawling out of my toilet to get a shitty shot. Ha ha, I cannot thank you and Bingo enough. The best goddamn friends a man can have. Still feeling wrong, my head is its own worst enemy. My very own crumbling nightmare circus is eating me alive. We should speak sometime when you get a moment. I fucking love me some goddamn Stanhope. I owe you my life. X Jughead. That was on May 31st. On June 3rd, as Chailey, Chad, Shank, and I were recording the Audible version for Digging Up Mother in the Funhouse, we took a break to eat and piss and drink some more. I turned on my cell phone and the text and voicemail notifications came rattling in like a Gatling gun. I was being sued for defamation by Amber Heard, and did I have any comment? Entertainment Tonight, Access Hollywood, every tabloid you can imagine filled my voicemail to capacity and continued to call faster than I could delete them. How do these parasites get your number? Some waited outside of my old West Hollywood apartment where Hennigan now lived to get comment. One guy even came to my house in Bisbee and walked right through the gate with a video camera. When I very politely declined to be interviewed, he asked if I'd be kind enough to allow him to get some footage of me throwing him off my property. Instead, I smiled and offered him suggestions on good places in town to grab some lunch. He had a British accent, so I assumed he'd come a long way. As distracting as all that became to the Audible recording, it was more than exciting, and I don't ever remember feeling any hint of concern. I was giddy. I don't understand people who say they hate drama. How can you hate drama? I love drama. It's the essence of life. It's an entire genre of film that almost exclusively takes home all the awards, while everybody says they love to laugh, but comedy isn't even nominated. I understand that the saying is usually in the context of contrived histrionics, but don't give unintended drama the bad name. Love and drama are the things that stay with you for life and ultimately define you. Everybody wants to be as close as possible to the house fire or the car crash without being in it. I remember every fist fight I've had, or more often the ones I had to sheepishly walk away from. I remember every time I had to call the police. Calling the cops is always a final option, so those instances when it's necessary mean there had to be a good story attached. I've had to talk to the FBI and file a restraining order against a stalker. Later, I talked to a friend who'd been through a similar situation, and she sympathized with me in how frightening it can be. Yeah, there was a certain adrenaline when he was seen on security camera coming into my house, but I held my tongue because part of me found it kind of fucking cool. Big drama. I love the tension in that moment when someone takes a phone call in the room and you see their face drop and you can read explicitly that someone has died. Even better when you're on the receiving end of that call, where there's that short delay before a grave and cracking voice asks, "Hey, did you hear?" I remember all the emotions I felt when Bingo found the corpse of Nowhere Man after he had shot himself through the temple in his bed, brains falling out and an eyeball dislodged from its socket. But most telling was my abject sense of envy. I wished that it had been me that found him. These are the moments that I shine. Why did it have to be Bingo, whose fragile mind is not cut out for these situations? The image continues to devastate her to this day. The details for me are nothing but secondhand imagination of what she told me, a mental illustration of something I'm certain I could have not only handled with aplomb, but digested the experience and made it into something bigger than art. I could have made it into comedy. The same way that Nowhere Man and a Whiskey Girl made their own deaths into something higher than romance. Because I remember the times that I've laughed in the face of adversity as much as I remember the love and the drama. If only it had been my story to tell. I love the rare occasion when something makes me cry, and not just because my soul is threadbare from nights of excess. It reminds me that I may still be human underneath all the callous and scarring. Sometimes I'll cry without feeling anything emotionally at all, like I'm bleeding without an obvious wound. So in context, a lawsuit from Amber Heard was as much comedy fodder as drama, but I ran with it nonetheless. I lawyered up quickly, and it was roundly assumed that this was a case that would never be pursued, that it was simply a ploy to get me to stop talking about it publicly. Which would prove to be a problem, as Bingo and I were returning to New York for one last run of press for the book. The trip started on an ominous beat. JFK had lost the one piece of luggage that held both of our medications, my booze and Bingo's psych pills. We both woke up with our heads in their natural habitats, a state which we try to stay away from with excessive force. With the lawsuit making the news, no media wanted to talk about the book anymore. They wanted to talk to me about Amber Heard, and quite frankly, I did too. There's no value in a good story if you can't tell it. Fuck the book. I want to talk mad shit about that demon. I wanted to counter-sue her for being a calculating, devious rodent, a dingleberry gone septic, and a walking, punchy stick trap waiting for any man or woman of notoriety to be impaled upon. But evidently none of that is actionable on either a civil or criminal level. What a shame. The real shame is that she never took me to court. The more I learned about it and contemplated it, the more desperately I wanted that lawsuit to happen. I don't know what her angle was, but for some reason, she decided to sue me in Cochise County, Arizona, where the county seat is Bisbee, population roughly 5,000. That means a jury of my peers, not to mention a good percentage of the rest of the courtroom top to bottom. I fantasized about her day in court falling on a Monday, where half the tribunal would still be hungover from football Sunday at the funhouse. I imagined her dining in the same places I'd recommended to the paparazzi who'd crashed my gate, and I giggled at all the things they might do to her meatloaf in the kitchen. But mostly, I fantasized about her winning. Before you sue me for everything I have, come down and see what you're playing for. Maybe you could take my house, but you'll never be able to sell the fucking thing. It's a cartoon littered in dog shit, and the dog comes with the house. Make sure to walk it. Oh, and could you check my mail while I'm on the road? Because when you get my house, I'll be living next door with the Traileys. I'll be your fucking neighbor. I'll take up chainsaw sculpture and practice from sunrise until Jimmy Fallon comes on at night, which I will blast through stadium speakers while I put in earplugs. I'll have Washtub Willie build me an outhouse with industrial fans installed over the sewage, constantly blowing in your direction. I'll be the guy who parks his 1994 Crown Vic from the police auction in front of your newly installed Tesla charging station so Elon Musk can't get any juice to get the fuck out of my town. And in Bisbee, there is no Uber. But none of these daydreams would ever come to fruition. The lawsuit, like the book press and the rest of that whirlwind of activity, seemed to die in the same moment like the final whistle of a game you never intended to play. The book had done well enough that I was given an offer to write a second. I was too delirious from all the promotion to remember how much of a grind the first one had been to write, and the tax that it took on me physically and emotionally as well as financially. Because while I was paid well in theory, the amount of time it took me away from stand-up made the book more of a personal challenge than a strong business decision. And like all the rest of the pandemonium of this year, not yet half over, the quiet set in again. Chapter 13. Time Off. Downtime is where drinking becomes a handicap of a different skin. Bored drinking. There's no celebration or big game, no heartbreak or confrontation, no stage to fear, no death to grieve. There's no upcoming flights. Of all the obstacles I can imagine if I were ever to get off the sauce, flying would be the most insurmountable. Not due to any fear, it's simply that air travel is my favorite environment for drinking. The mere fact that Tucson Airport starts serving at 6 a.m. enforces the idea that you should take full advantage. Since I'm normally upgraded to first class where drinks are free and they bring them to you before you've ever left the ground, this makes you feel like you'd be squandering the experience should you decline. The fact that most of my flights on Delta hubbed through Atlanta, where there was still smoking bars, well, how could you not indulge in such a rare opportunity? There's so many reasons to drink, and very few that cry for abstinence. Now, when the tornado of legal action, hosting, filming, recording, and media tours has dissipated, and the calm is more menacing still, you feel like the fighter who's just been knocked out in the ring, only to come to still swinging haymakers from his back on instinct. It's hard to process that the bout is over. You walk into a silent house, drop your bags just inside the door, and you stare at all your shit like you're making a nostalgic visit to the house you grew up in. The dog wags its tail and then walks away. You wonder if it even missed you. The cat cries for treats because it's long given up on the idea of companionship. These animals are less rescues than refugees. You smell the air inside. After a long absence, a bad odor is the first thing to tell you if anything is amiss. You check the fridge to see if there's anything left to eat unspoiled. The stack of mail is too much of a burden to consider. You have time now. Time to get back to real life and a life that hasn't been real for decades and never will be. You'll get to everything eventually. You resign yourself to the bar in the funhouse alone and pour yourself that long overdue drink that you worked so hard for and you exhale. The phone that had been aglow night and day seems now like it's been disconnected. You turn on the television hoping to find a game to dumb you down and you're not disappointed to find out that it's still summer and all that's on is baseball. Baseball is boring and that's the point. White noise to quell the cacophony of enemies in your head, to stop swinging at opponents who've long since left the arena. And you sit there and you wait for Chaley and Tracy. This is another irritant about Chaley. He's constantly working to make my life better, and that can be at the expense of making me drink alone. We'll come off the road and Chaley will immediately start unpacking and opening mail and paying bills and doing all the things that I'd just ignored while I'm sitting alone watching baseball, kicking off a binge that will last for more than a fortnight. And he makes Tracy help him, which annoys me even more and is another reason that Tracy has never annoyed me, because she'd be drinking with me if she could, except for that goddamn Chaley. For the record, a fortnight is 2 weeks. I just